Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Miller, a specialist on Latin America with Amnesty International USA, who reports on growing human rights violations by paramilitary groups connected with Colombian armed forces, recipient of a large share of $1.3 billion in U.S. aid. Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, who assesses new European Union rules governing the testing and sale of genetically engineered foods and pharmaceuticals. And Karen Hansen-Kuhn, international coordinator with Alliance for Responsible Trade, who examines the free trade area of the Americas negotiations, which will culminate in a summit meeting attended by 34 heads of state in Quebec City, Canada, this April. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After she went 8 days past her due date, pregnant mother Susanna Altamari followed the advice of her obstetrician and jump-started her labor. She took 2 doses of Cytotic, a drug that softens the cervix and creates uterine contractions much more powerful than in typical labor. What Altamari did not realize is that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had not approved the use of the drug in pregnant women. Thus far, the FDA has only allowed use of the drug Cytotic, produced by the G.D. Searle Corporation, for treating peptic ulcers. Recently, the drug maker issued a warning stating that use of Cytotic during labor can cause the uterus to rupture and cause severe bleeding, infertility, or death. According to Mother Jones magazine, after going into active labor in 1995, the heartbeat of Altamari's fetus went faint and her uterus ruptured, causing internal bleeding which left the fetus without oxygen. The baby died 3 days later, and Altamari was left infertile for the rest of her life. Last year, she reached a $2 million out-of-court settlement with her doctor. Despite the dangers, a growing number of OBGYN doctors are using drugs to force labor in pregnant women. Cytotic is cheap to use, only 25 cents per dose. Sometimes this treatment is ordered to protect the mother's health, but most of the time it is done for the doctor's convenience. Dr. Martin Wagner, who ran women's health programs at the World Health Organization for 15 years, charges Cytotic enables doctors to practice daylight obstetrics. It means as a doctor, I can come in at 9 a.m., give you a pill, and by 6 p.m., I've delivered the baby and I'm home having dinner. The news magazine In These Times reports that Richard Armitage, a major figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, has been named as Colin Powell's chief deputy at the U.S. State Department. In the mid-1980s, Armitage was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and worked at several important diplomatic posts during the first Bush administration. During the Reagan years, Armitage was a major target in a lawsuit filed by the now-defunct Christic Institute, which charged that officials like Richard Secord, who ran the covert campaign to supply weapons to the right-wing Contra forces seeking to oust the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua, were really just part of a larger conspiracy, known as the Secret Team, a network of military and intelligence operatives involved in illegal activities dating back to the late 1950s. According to the lawsuit, which was eventually thrown out of court, Armitage played an important role in diverting drug profits from Laos and Thailand to fund assassination plots in Vietnam and Iran. The right wing also attacked Armitage for what they believed were his lackluster efforts to identify MIAs in Vietnam. Conservative anger at Armitage cost the longtime Republican the post of Secretary of the Army in 1989. He was also damaged by a criminal investigation that linked him with a Vietnamese immigrant, Nguyen T. O'Rourke, who was convicted of running a gambling operation in Northern Virginia. TV investigative journalists Steve Wilson and Jane Aker have won an historic legal victory. The two were fired from WTVT, the Fox News station in Tampa, Florida, for producing a critical series on genetically engineered BGH hormone, which is fed to cows to promote increased milk production. After they were fired, Wilson and Aker filed a lawsuit against Fox News. The case went to trial last August, and a Florida jury found that Fox had violated Aker's rights under the state's whistleblower law and awarded her $425,000 in damages. In an interview with Extra, the magazine published by the Media Watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Aker said it's precedent-setting. The fact that a journalist can use the whistleblower law if they get fired deserves to be widely known. Fox News is appealing the verdict, in part on the dubious grounds that there is no law that forbids news organizations from deliberately distorting facts. Wilson and Aker charge that Fox News wanted them to redo their investigative series in a way that pleased Monsanto, the company that makes the BGH hormone. In 1997, Monsanto strongly objected to the Wilson and Aker report and sent a letter of protest to Fox News president Roger Ailes. In taking their case to the courts and fighting Fox News over censorship, Wilson and Aker were forced to sell their home and depleted their savings. Yet their case stirred little media interest, and few reporters have bothered to dig into the potential human health effects of using BGH in milk production. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When Congress approved a $1.3 billion military and economic aid package for the nation of Colombia last year, lawmakers attached specific human rights conditions to curb the well-documented abuses by the military. But despite a unified front from human rights groups opposed to certifying Colombian compliance with these conditions, former President Clinton signed a waiver in August allowing the aid to go forward. According to supporters, the assistance, much of it directed to the Colombian military, will help Bogotá more effectively fight the drug war. But critics warn that the U.S. position ignores the danger of becoming entangled in Colombia's decades-long civil war that pits two well-armed rebel groups against an army and paramilitary units accused of corruption and gross human rights abuses. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Andrew Miller, Acting Advocacy Director for the Americas with Amnesty International USA, who reports on growing human rights violations by paramilitary groups linked with the Colombian armed forces in the northeastern city of Barranca Bermeja.
Colombia has a long history of violent civil conflict. In its current incarnation, there are various sort of left-wing guerrilla groups that cropped up in Colombia in the 60s, as they did in many areas throughout Latin America following the Cuban Revolution in 1959. But since that time, there's been a very intense civil conflict going on between various different actors, different guerrilla groups, the Colombian security forces, and in the last 20 years, right-wing paramilitary groups, which are financed by different economic interests, but work hand in glove with the Colombian military. Some of the characteristics of this conflict, unfortunately, are that all armed actors in Colombia are implicated in serious human rights violations, which include abductions of civilians, indiscriminate attacks. In the 80s, there was much more in the way of political imprisonments and torture, but in the 90s, that turned a lot more into disappearances, selective killings, and massacres. So in Colombia, annually, we're seeing about 3,500 politically motivated killings. There's a very strong counter-drug discourse that we hear in Washington, D.C., but there's a lot of concerns about sort of the interchangeability of these kinds of weapons and this kinds of training. What are the distinctions between counter-narcotics and counterinsurgency? And it's really been put into question, this distinction, because the U.S. aid is focusing in the southern part of the country, sort of coincidentally close to where the FARC, Colombia's largest guerrilla group, have their stronghold, whereas this aid is not focusing in other areas of the country where there is drug cultivation going on, where there is drug production going on, or where the drugs are leaving from Colombia. So we're kind of scratching our heads a little bit about what the real motivations of this aid is.
In the news recently is the Colombian city of Barranca Bermeja, where the paramilitary groups thought to be connected with the Colombian army has been operating, threatening civilians and international human rights groups. I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Barranca is a particularly strategic area. It's where a lot of Colombia's oil refining is carried out. And it's located right along the Magdalena River, which runs into the Atlantic, kind of goes right down Colombia. So it's very strategic. It's also close to where some coca is being grown. There are gold deposits in the area. And it's a longtime stronghold of the ELN, the second largest armed opposition group in Colombia. So the paramilitaries have really focused in on this region in the last couple of years. And what that has meant is as I've described earlier, are an increase in selective killings and massacres and displacement. So in Barranca, there's also a long history of collaboration with the military there. And what we've seen this year alone, we've seen dozens of selective killings there. The town itself is incredibly heavily militarized. There are military checkpoints throughout the town, and so we kind of wonder how it is that the paramilitaries are able to drive around openly. They're carrying their weapons. They're in uniforms. How it is that they're not being confronted by the security forces kind of baffles us. The only real explanation would be that, in fact, they're working together. But human rights groups in Barranca that have been working with the civilian population, unionists, and many others have been systematically targeted. Because of that situation, some international human rights observers have moved in. Peace Brigades International is one group that's been there for about 6 years. And about a week and a half ago, one of the PBI members, a European, was told by two paramilitaries that he was a military objective, which in essence is a death threat coming from the paramilitaries. So that in and of itself is sort of indicative of the decline that we're seeing in Colombia, not only for Colombians who are working on behalf of human rights, but also internationals.
There was a recent meeting between Colombian President Andres Pastrana and the leader of the FARC guerrilla group. What role do you feel the United States military aid is going to play here? Is it going to be some leverage to get concessions from the guerrillas? Is it going to maybe exacerbate the situation and create more violence? What's your view?
Well, Amnesty's view is that increased military aid to Colombia is not something that's going to ameliorate the conflict there, and then in fact it's going to exacerbate the situation. In a sense, our concern is that it emboldens the Colombian military, it emboldens sectors of the Colombian society who then might think that the gringos will always be ready and willing to sort of save them. To chip in or to escalate the military aid. And there might be people in Colombia who think that it is possible to win this war militarily, and it really isn't.
That was Andrew Miller, Latin American specialist with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 202-544-0200 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. The European Union Parliament recently voted 338-52 to adopt strict rules governing the testing, cultivation, and sale of genetically modified organisms for use in food and pharmaceuticals. The new standards, which must be incorporated into the laws of each of the EU's 15 member nations, will likely pave the way for ending Europe's 3-year moratorium prohibiting the distribution of genetically engineered, or GE, products. But members of European Green parties and the governments of France and Denmark say they will resist the adoption of the new rules. While the EU provisions will set up a system for tracking the location of GE crops, require companies wishing to sell genetically altered foods to apply for licenses, and eventually mandate consumer labeling of foods, the public remains skeptical of what some derisively refer to as Frankenfoods. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, who assesses the new EU rules and their likely effect on agriculture and public health.
the latest rule by the European Union Parliament, the measure that has been adopted, which is establishing rules on genetically modified organisms, it is actually preparing to end Europe's unofficial moratorium on bioengineered seeds and food. And it's actually very disheartening because this 338-52 vote happened despite intense suspicions and a very strong people's movement in Europe around genetically modified foods. And these rules govern the testing and the planting and sale of crops and food. But I think given what Europe is facing right now, especially around BSE and the mad cow disease, it's no longer a scare. It's an epidemic in countries like Germany and France. I just find it shocking that they're getting ready to end the Europe's moratorium. And basically, it's a call to the rest of the people's movement that we have to garner up our resistance even more to challenge it.
There certainly seems to be a battle going on for acceptance of genetically engineered foods in Europe. I'm wondering what role you feel this new ruling by the European Union will play in public opinion.
Well, Scott, one thing that I would like to point out that promoters of biotechnology have very often criticized the other side, calling us, bogus science or Luddites or whatever. One thing that we have to acknowledge is that this is truly a people's movement. It has farmers, it has scientists, it has consumers, mom and pops who care about what the children eat. So it is a very diverse movement. It is not just a bunch of, Luddites or as I don't think there's anything wrong with Luddites, by the way. But it is really, scientists have joined in too. The other thing that I want to point out is that even respected scientific journals such as Nature or Science have put out a call for the need for adequate testing. Now, we have genuine concerns given only 1% of the USDA budget, which is like $1 million, is allocated for any kind of risk assessment of whether it's biotechnology seeds or biotech viruses or biotech animals. It's hardly any amount that has been put aside, and the private sector, which is already reaping profits from it, is not willing to put any money for any kind of risk assessment. So having said that, I think it's very important to look at that statement about people not knowing enough science. I mean, that's what was said when, the nuclear reactors first came into being. It took us a lot of environmental destruction and deaths before we could acknowledge what is wrong with the nuclear industry. So we don't have to repeat those mistakes again or say that you don't know enough science. We know that we cannot always completely trust our scientists. We cannot always completely trust our academia, especially when they've been bought up by corporations, as we are seeing again around genetic engineering. And in terms of what is driving the movement in Europe, I think it is the same force which is driving the movement in a lot of third world. It is the same force which is driving the movement even in the U.S. Europe has gone through the fear of what happened with the mad cow disease. They are going through what it's going to mean for the small farmers. I think when we talk about biotechnology of a food system, we have to look at it not just in terms of what's going to happen to our environment or be concerned about it as consumers. We have to look at it at the implications of the food producers. The small farmers are losing their right to be able to control the seed. Here we have corporations who are going to be controlling the seed, which is the most central part of food production. We have never seen consolidation of a food system in such a manner as we're going to see now. So all those factors have come together from environmental concerns to environmental justice that are the driving force. Approximately 800 million people in this world do not have enough to eat, of which about 250 to 300 million live in my country in India. And last year, Indian government was boasting of a 44 million ton surplus, which is being exported to the West to feed the cattle. It is not buying any more grains from the farmers because it isn't such a surplus. Farmers are burning their crops in the fields. It is totally a problem of distribution. So if we really want to end hunger in the world, what research at Food First has shown year after year over the last 25 years is we need genuine land reform. We need people's access and control over food producing resources. And we need living wage jobs. Until we have those, any technology, biotechnology, genetic engineering, will not make a dent in hunger.
In terms of food safety, what's your response really to those companies like Monsanto who say that no one has proven that genetically engineered foods are unsafe or a threat to public health? How do you respond to that?
Well, Scott, I would say that given the time and time of history that we live in, given that all the different mistakes we have made in the past, I think the burden of proof is on the other side. It is on the industry to show that it is indeed safe. Until they can do that, we have to follow the precautionary principle. Precautionary principle, to put it in simple terms, would mean that we have to err on the side of safety, that till we know it is really safe, these products should not be on our market shelves.
That was Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Contact Food First by calling area code 510-654-4400. Or visit their website at www.foodfirst.org. In April, heads of state from nations around the Americas will gather in Quebec City, Canada, for negotiations on the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty. Once ratified, the FTAA will put in place a hemisphere-wide trade agreement based on the controversial North American Free Trade Agreement under the framework of the World Trade Organization. Although much of the negotiations have been held in secret, the agreement is widely expected to give unprecedented new rights to multinational corporations, with little or no provisions protecting labor rights and the environment. Many unions, human rights, and environmental groups oppose adoption of FTAA, seeing it as another component of corporate-led economic globalization that pits worker against worker and nation against nation in a race to the bottom. Thousands of activists will be converging in Quebec in April to attend an alternative people's summit and to hold protest demonstrations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Karen Hansen-Kuhn, international coordinator with the Alliance for Responsible Trade, who examines the FTAA and why so many groups across the Western Hemisphere are organizing to oppose it.
The Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, will be an agreement that includes all of the countries of the hemisphere except Cuba, and it is basically the NAFTA model. So it will liberalize trade, but it also has provisions on investment, services, intellectual property rights, a whole range of basically corporate rights, freeing up flows of capital and goods without any kind of built-in social protections. Now, what will be happening in Quebec will be a meeting of all the presidents of the Americas, again, except Cuba, to talk about the future direction of the trade agreement. Now, I should mention as well that actually the trade ministers will be meeting shortly before the Quebec meeting in Buenos Aires, which will be more of a technical meeting, but there is a big demonstration planned there as well. The unions there have promised there will be at least 100,000 people turning out on the streets.
And maybe you could summarize for us, why are so many groups, labor, human rights, environmental groups, opposed to the Free Trade Area of the Americas Agreement?
Well, I think there's several reasons. I think, you know, the people I work with are looking at what's happened with NAFTA, first of all, since that clearly is the model for this other agreement. And, you know, in this country, we know over 300,000 people have lost their jobs, and it's become much harder for workers to organize in factories because employers are using the threat of moving production to undermine union drives. In Mexico, wages have fallen even though productivity has gone up, and family farmers have been driven off their lands because they can't compete with corn imports coming from the United States. So I think people in South America, they have in the Southern Cone what's called the Mercosur, the common market of the Southern Cone, and they think that it would be better for the countries in South America and Latin America to develop their own integration first that's more among equals, and then consider, you know, integrating with the powerhouses in the north, that they'd be in, you know, a better framework to do that. They'd have more negotiating strength. But this whole thing is really rushing through. They're hoping to put it all in place by the year 2005.
Is there any blueprint that you've offered that would provide an alternative approach to improving trade relations between the countries of the Americas?
We have a document that's called Alternatives for the Americas, which is developed not just by our coalition, but by people throughout the hemisphere. It's a document of this Hemispheric Social Alliance. And it has chapters on issues that are in the official negotiations, like market access and investment, and also chapters on issues that should be in a good integration agreement but aren't, like labor and environment and human rights. We presented the first version of that document at the last presidential summit in Santiago, Chile, and international teams have been working on a new version, which will be ready, I think, next month. And we include provisions like, for example, under investment, instead of banning any kind of capital controls, we say governments should have the right to regulate investment. We also suggest something called a Tobin tax, that a small tax on speculative capital, which would help to slow down hot money that really destabilizes countries and could also generate resources to help bring standards up throughout the hemisphere rather than driving them down. So this is a document that will continue to evolve, but we certainly have been using it both in official forums, presenting it to the governments, and in our own educational efforts.
How much mobilizing is going on around the Free Trade of the Americas agreement and the summit? Maybe you could just lay out for us sort of the environment here in which the FTAA negotiations will be taking place.
Well, one thing I found really interesting is that there are a number of student groups around the country who have really become engaged in this issue. They started contacting us recently, not even so much to ask for help, but to tell us they were carrying out workshops, they had these programs going on, and could we work together? So I'm seeing really heavy involvement by student groups in different parts of the country, solidarity groups. One of our most active members is the Mexico Solidarity Network, which is also doing workshops around the country. Environmentalists and family farm groups are concerned as well. And I think, you know, when you think about the People's Summit, it's also important to remember that this is, you know, a summit of the peoples of the Americas, plural, and there is very heavy engagement from particularly unions and environmental groups, development groups in Latin America as well. In fact, there was a meeting in Brazil a couple of weeks ago in Porto Alegre, the World Social Forum, where the FTA became a big issue as well. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of activities on the days of the People's Summit. In fact, there will be simultaneous demonstrations in a number of countries in the Americas.
That was Karen Hansen-Kuhn, International Coordinator with the Alliance for Responsible Trade. Contact the Alliance at area code 202-898-1566 or visit their website at www.art-us.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.